Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this special edition of General Talk, marking the coronation of King Charles III. We open with Royal Standard. Under the direction of the late Major Roger Swift. In the coming days, the nation will be swept up in the ritual, tradition and pageantry of coronation. As villages, towns and cities up and down the land and throughout the Commonwealth celebrate the dawn of the Caroline era, marking the new reign of our sovereign and commander-in-chief, King Charles III, and his Queen Camilla. Royal commentator and Governor of Edinburgh Castle, Major General Alistair Bruce, explains why a monarch is crowned.
The change of reign starts with a sad moment in the death of a sovereign, and I think that the nation recognised that in the funeral. And the conclusion of the change of reign comes with a very joyous moment, which is coronation. It confirms the commitment of the new monarch through faith to the business of leadership. And it's a servant leadership for which a Christian monarch looks to the example of Jesus Christ. And as part of the whole thing, it sits within the sacrament of Holy Communion, and the sacrament of unction, or the anointing, is probably the most key part that the new king will go through. And in terms of the history of our nation, this will be the first coronation that is over 1,000 years old. The reason that we crown a sovereign is, as it were, to put a halo over a head that has been anointed, and that is the purpose of a crown. Although the crowning is perhaps what everybody will remember because they've seen it, it emphasizes that hidden moment when the king is changed. But great national events carry on a chapter of continuity, and that's what kingship is about. And to see the monarch wearing the imperial state crown, which again was made for Queen Victoria at her coronation in the 1830s, with St. Edward's sapphire in the top cross pate, with the Black Prince's ruby and the cross pate at the front of the circlet. You know, these are stones that have witnessed so much of our history. And there at the end of a day, a new king, a new reign, but it's merely the human story of continuity that every family lives, because we go generation to generation. And while it is the settled constitutional desire of the country to have a constitutional monarchy, I think it is reassuring to see, in a time when the world is in great flux and change, that with confidence and with the support of the armed forces, in loyal presence during the whole of the day, the king has formally started in joy his reign.
But what of Charles III, our new king? Former chief correspondent of the BBC, Kate Adey.
He has got years of experience of being able to say things to strangers, a little repartee. It's always very cautious. It never gives much away. But it's an extraordinary knack, which, you know, the at-ease members of the royal family manage. And I've seen it with the new king, time and again, at charity events. I've been lucky enough, connected to charities, to go to receptions. And they're in the evening, usually in somewhere very glamorous, in Buckingham Palace or St. James's or whatever. And there's often over 100, 120, 30 people there. Often young people, very nervous, all, you know, their first taste of this kind of extraordinary, rather, gosh, in your face, furniture and scarlet and gold and official people standing around. And they're usually divided into groups, maybe a dozen, standing in groups. And Prince Charles, as he then was, I've seen him time and again, go from group to group and manage to talk to pretty well everyone, or clusters of them. And when you've seen it going on for over 2 hours, you say to yourself, gosh, if I go to a party, I'm lucky if I actually can manage, you know, a couple of groups of people and then say, I think I need a drink and let's go and find a friend. But I've seen him after 2.5, almost 3 hours, with the last group still going around them assiduously, listening to people, picking someone out, having a word with them. It is a job, and it's hard. It may be cushioned in so many ways, but heavens, it's a job. And it's kept going by this extraordinary ability to produce what we would call, I suppose, exquisite manners with everyone. And it's remarkable.
At 74 years old, when most people are thinking, as you say, as you sort of intimate about hanging up their boots and enjoying a retirement, he's now stepping up to the big job. What do you think will be the hallmarks of his reign in comparison to his mother's?
I think he'll continue. He's with tradition. He likes tradition, and he's been part of it for so long that I don't see any major changes. I suspect that will happen with his son, who is of a different generation and had a different upbringing, went to university, a much more modern upbringing compared to his own. I think he'll be traditionalist. Some things will change, and he has enthusiasm. Certain things he cares very deeply about. But it will be, I think, steady as she goes. Not too many surprises. Some things will change. But he's been waiting to do this for a long time. I suspect he has some plans. We shall see. And it will be a continuation of that traditional style. But he's much more, of course, approachable. I used to wonder when interviewed him. I remember stopping him on the stairs of a building somewhere in Canada, no, America, when he was in the Rust Belt, Cleve, somewhere like Ohio. And just as he was going up the stairs, you know, sort of put a microphone forward and said, and he saw me and he said, ah, he said, so, you know, you off, you know, with a little interview. And I remember thinking afterwards, I wonder if this will happen when he is king. I rather suspect it will.
Royal biographer Robert Hardman.
It's been a very hasty start to the reign. When you think that when the Queen acceded to the throne in 1952, it was 10 months before people actually heard her say anything. And that was her Christmas broadcast at the end of 1952, whereas King Charles III, we heard him address the nation, well, a day after he became king. And he alluded to it in his speech in that broadcast where he talked about making the most of the years God grants me. I sense this is a king who's not hanging around. That's for very understandable reasons. He's going to be 75 this autumn. He is already the oldest new monarch, if you like. And so I think it'll be a dynamic reign. I think it'll be possibly more transparent. He likes to plow into crowds and shake hands. He'll be actively involved in issues that we know are of interest to him. But I just think he's given it enough thought for long enough to know what the pitfalls are, and he's not going to fall into them.
Royal photographer Arthur Edwards.
Harry, I can tell you now, he's an amazing man. And, you know, it's no secret, you know, he's my favourite member of the royal family. And it has been for a very long while. He's, no one's perfect, but, you know, he's done his best. He's done his best for the benefit of others. I've been to every rainforest in the world with him. I've been three times to the Amazon rainforest. I've been to the rainforest in New Zealand, in Australia, in Cameroon, in... the New Guinea, you know, everywhere with him. And he's desperate to stop this precious resource being ripped up. He's been campaigning for over 30 years for that. We're not doing it for us. We're doing it for our children, our grandchildren. And he never stops going on about it. Harry keeps this pressure on himself to do this when, you know, he could easily be playing backgammon all day, drinking champagne, going to the races. It's nothing like that at all. He's a very frugal man. He never eats lunch. He takes good care of himself. And he works incredibly hard.
Arthur Edwards offers us a glimpse of the then Prince of Wales during a visit to the Vatican in 2017.
We were in Rome, and I'm a practicing Catholic, and have been all my life. And the Prince of Wales, as he was then, and Camilla were going to meet the Pope, Pope Francis. And we have to draw for who does it. I was standing outside the Vatican. I did the Pope arriving, and then all of a sudden, his press secretary came out and said, "Put your camera down, come with me." And I walked into the Pope's office, and Prince Wales said, "Holy Father," he said, "this man is the most important man in the room. He's been working with me for over 40 years, and he's a Catholic." And the Pope beamed, he smiled, lit his face, and I shook his hand, and Camilla said something, and it was very nice. They all laughed. It was quite funny. And then, of course, the Pope said, "Pray for me." Well, that was a great moment for me. Now, that wouldn't have happened if Prince Charles, as he was then, hadn't asked, because all names have to be submitted 2 weeks before. He arranged that. He fixed that. That for me was a personal moment. It was just lovely. And of course, that wouldn't have happened but for him.
The most notable change for the monarchy is the King's new cipher and crown. Alistair Bruce.
The King has chosen to have a crown that mirrors the Tudor design that his grandfather and great-grandfather used, and also Edward VII, and to a certain degree, even Queen Victoria, which is what is more of an imperial arch. That is that the arches going across and from front to rear of the crown continually rise to the mond, which is like a small orb at the central crossing point. And therefore, having done that, the cap badges and all representations of the crown, except interestingly for the Royal Regiment of Scotland, who use the Crown of Scots in their badge, but also the ciphers are all being changed on the uniforms of the Yeomen of the Guard, on those of anyone like the state trumpeters who have in the past had E2R, they now have C3R. And I think that that is obviously a very visible change, and it is part of the semiotics of that change in a reign that we're used to in the armed forces.
The first recorded coronation in Britain took place in 973 AD at Bath Abbey, when St Dunstan crowned King Edgar. But does this ancient ceremony, dating back over a millennium and not seen in the country for over 70 years, still have a place in multicultural society today? Royal biographer Robert Hardman.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's like saying, is there a role for a ceremony once a year on December the 25th to mark the birth of a baby in a manger in 2,000 years ago? I mean, yes is the answer. It roots us in past and present. The template for it sits in the Old Testament, the Book of Kings. And I mean, the idea of anointing oil, I mean, you can go back as far as the Book of Exodus, and there it is. So it is very ancient. But, you know, at its heart is something, I would say, eternal, which is a sort of bond between a monarch and the people. It's almost like a kind of a marriage ceremony between the sovereign and the subjects. And, yeah, people might say, well, it's all a bit irrational. You know, what are we doing with crowns and scepters in the 21st century? Well, life is irrational. You know, you look at any aspect of the ritual and ceremonial in our lives, but actually we're all the better for it. These are the moments that around which we can frame a modern truth. You know, here is our head of state, but we do it in a way that gives it grandeur and dignity, and also, frankly, solemnity. At its heart, it's both a constitutional and a religious event, and those things, two things, I hope, are still important whatever century we live in.
The coronation anthem, I Was Glad, composed by Hubert Parry, sung by the choir of King's College, Cambridge, under the musical direction of Stephen Clearbury. 70 years ago, in 1953, our late Queen's coronation took place. As the great day drew close, so preparations at Westminster Abbey began, including the construction of scaffolding stands to enable television to record the event and to hold the many thousands of guests invited to attend. George Lorne, then 17 years old, was a musician in the band of the Life Guards.
Each unit in London had to provide 100 men, and we then had to march from Knightsbridge to the Abbey one evening. And when we got there, we climbed up on the scaffolding inside the Abbey, and there was a Welsh Guard Sergeant Major down below who just stood there and said, "Right, when I say jump, jump up and down." And that's what we did. There was hundreds and hundreds of troops all in the Abbey, jumping up and down. It didn't matter whether half the British Army got killed, as long as the nobility was okay. Then we had to march back to Knightsbridge.
The date was set for the 2nd of June. 91-year-old Stan Pell, who served with the Royal Signals and is now a resident at the Royal Star and Garter Home, Solihull, explains why.
And they picked that day because it hadn't rained on that day for years, and it poured down all day.
Vanessa De Morgan wanted to see the fun for herself.
Oh, I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I was 18, and I came up to London, and I was staying with my sister. And we decided that we wanted to go and be part of the crowd. So we went with her, she had a boyfriend at the time, and we went, the three of us went, and we decided that we were to sit probably in the centre where there was going to be a procession. So we went to Piccadilly, and we sat there all night. Unbelievably, really. It was quite chilly. It hadn't started raining at that stage.
87-year-old Korean War veteran Bob Sewell, then living in Hook, former chef in the Army Catering Corps and now resident at the Royal Star and Garter Home, Surbiton, recalls Coronation Day.
We had a radio, and that was run by accumulator electricity. It described everything that was happening, and it was quite exciting, really. The whole area was decorated. There was streamers everywhere and little Union Jacks.
More than 20 million people watched the service on television, outnumbering the radio audience for the first time. The Queen's coronation put TV on the map. Royal photographer Arthur Edwards.
I was 12 years of age. I used to run the only woman in our street who had a television. I used to run errands for her on a Saturday. I used to go and get her shopping, and she used to give me 10 pence, which was a lot of money then. And the coronation came, and I said, Mrs. Ash, her name was. I said, can I come and watch the coronation? And she said, yes. And I went in, and I spent 3 hours watching it. And it was on a little 9-inch black and white television, flickering and, you know, muzzy. But watched it. Yeah, it was quite amazing.
In London, the morning began with exciting news. Vanessa De Morgan.
And we were very well rewarded because in the morning, very early in the morning, it was announced that we'd conquered the Everest and came over the Alps. So it was a terribly exciting moment.
Major Hugh Cantley, then an ensign with the 2nd Battalion of Scots Guards, who were lining the route, was carrying the Queen's colour.
And we must have marched from Chelsea Barracks. And the place was very crowded, full of people. So we then lined up, took our dressing, and waited. And there was a pause when there was a clatter of a carriage coming down the wall to the way to the Abbey. somebody said, it's Princess Margaret. And the company was saying, that's a royal salute, sir. But unfortunately, a few moments before, police horses stopped opposite me and it got rid of all its breakfast right in front of me. And I said, well, I can't lower the colour. She said, lower the colour. Right. Colour party, royal salute. And I brought it up, swept it round over the steaming pile. And then when she'd passed, colour party, no, resume. And up it came. And I had a face full of horse breakfast. As well as smearing the royal colour. Anyway, that was
Vanessa De Morgan.
And my main memory was of the Queen of Tonga, who came in an open carriage, and she was the only one. Everybody else, because it was raining and it was miserable, and she was so brave about sitting there, and everyone was cheering her as she came by. It was a wonderful moment.
The ceremony of crowning a monarch, which sits at the heart of a coronation, remains largely unchanged. But the nature, scale and form of the pomp, pageantry and celebration that surrounds the occasion is shaped by the character of the sovereign, the mood of government and the state of the public purse, making every coronation a unique public statement, heralding the beginning of a reign and the start of a new era. The secret to success in these complex ceremonies is in their detailed planning, which began early last autumn after our late Queen's funeral. Major General Christopher Geeker, General Officer commanding London District, explains the process.
Within Horse Guards Headquarters Household Division in London District, there's been a planning group. And then, of course, there's a lot of partners who we have to work very closely with. So obviously the Royal Household, the Metropolitan Police, Westminster City Council, government departments and so forth. So I think we produced two or three options in the autumn. One of those was selected, and then we've built on that one going forward.
What are the challenges in preparing everybody for this?
So I think the first is to rehearse everybody in their own barracks or concentration area. And so all the regiments of the Army, the Navy, the Air Force have spent some time in their home locations preparing themselves. And then gradually all the Army regiments have come together as an Army contingent to rehearse at Sandhurst, the Navy, the Portsmouth, the RAF, RAF Halton. And then once those three service contingents have been assured and are ready, then you bring it all together. And then we did that for the first time on Sunday on the runway at RAF Odeum, and we'll do it a second time tonight on the streets of London.
On Saturday, the 6th of May, the coronation service at Westminster Abbey begins at 11 a.m, with their Majesties leaving Buckingham Palace at 10:20 in the King's procession, travelling in the Diamond Jubilee State Coach, drawn by six Windsor Greys, with a sovereign's escort provided by the Household Cavalry. After the coronation service, their Majesties will return to Buckingham Palace in the Gold State Coach as part of the coronation procession. Their Majesties will then receive a salute from the British and Commonwealth Armed Forces in the Palace Gardens, and after appear on the Buckingham Palace balcony.
How many people are involved in the two processions?
So how many are involved is a difficult question to answer, because, of course, there will be the people on parade, 4,000 or 5,000, and then the streetliners. But then there's an enormous contingent of people, thousands, involved in transport and logistics and planning and operations and so forth. So, you know, we're up to sort of 7,000 people when you take it all in. And if you look at more broadly and take it to a broader extent, you know, we're not far short of 10,000 people. The procession will be led by the brigade major and four senior non-commissioned officers of the Household Cavalry, and then the King Street Royal Horse Artillery. And they will start from about three quarters of the way up the Mall. Behind them is a procession of a mile and a half, going down the Mall, through Trafalgar Square, down Whitehall, through Parliament Square, to the Gold State Coach at Westminster Abbey. There are going to be eight procession groups, and I'm going to be at the front of procession group eight, which is the household troops. So there are a very large number of contingents from the Commonwealth, but they add a really important element to this, because they help us all to remember. Of course, the King has a position as head of the Commonwealth. They're colourful. It's really, I think, tremendously important for all of us that they are able to take part. And so they're a welcome and very, very important element to this.
So that is presumably making quite a call on uniforms, and I imagine tailors are beavering away right now at present. What is the greatest challenge you have faced in putting together this mega procession?
So I think the challenge is in the sort of incremental build through training. So, you know, each regiment and their detachments, the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, have rehearsed extensively in their own home locations, their own barracks. And then bit by bit, we brought each element together. And I think the challenge comes when you start to integrate one particular detachment with others. So, for example, you know, if you take a regiment, say the Loamshires, you know, they rehearse in their barracks, and then they get together with the other people from their procession group. That's happened at Sand. We've used Sandhurst, which is in recess at the moment, so we've used the roads around Sandhurst. And then you bring all the army together, and then you add the Navy and the RAF and the Household Division, and suddenly you can see that actually people are part of a huge enterprise. And I think the challenge comes when you start to bring the groups together, because you then realize that, of course, no one person or group can act in isolation, because what everybody does has an effect on the whole. And of course, that is, if you think about it, the basis of military discipline. And that's why we act as we do, because, you know, the group is stronger than any one individual.
For Alistair Bruce, the most important moment of the coronation on the 6th of May will be the king's anointing.
When the king will be divested of all the splendour of kingship. And the original coronation did it best when sovereigns were then laid on the ground, a cloth was placed across them, and prayers for the dead were said over them before they were, as it were, raised up into a new life and anointed. And the king will be literally asked to remove most of his upper garments in order that he can be anointed with oil on the breast, on the head, and on the palms of his hands. And if you have a faith, I think that is a really meaningful moment.
Royal biographer Robert Hardman.
I absolutely love Zadok the Priest. I just think it's such a powerful piece of music. It's played every year at the Royal Maundy service, and it's absolute hairs on the back of your neck stuff. Just to hear that being played in the Abbey at the crowning moment, for me, that's what I'm looking forward to. And I mean, all the other stuff would be great, coaches and carriages and processions, that'll be wonderful too, but you really don't see the monarch being crowned very often. I did in my lifetime.
Coronation anthem, Zadok the Priest, composed by George Frederick Handel, sung by the choir of King's College, Cambridge, under the musical direction of Stephen Clearbury. For broadcast and historian Peter Snow's family, the 6th of May will be a working day.
I think it'll be a wonderful day, and I think there'll be all sorts of excitements going on. My son, Dan, who is half Canadian, and my wife, who is fully Canadian, will be performing on the CBC television network in Canada, the Canadian Broadcasting Company. They will be sitting beside the presenter, and they will be chatting away and being asked questions. Anne and my wife is very keen. She was a journalist in London for the Canadian Broadcasting. She will be there explaining all about the royal family. On the other side of the presenter will be Dan, who will be telling us all about the history of the royal family and its relationship with Canada. Canada regards the coronation, I think, as wonderfully important and rather lovely and decorative occasion, which, I mean, you know, I think Republicans take this all too seriously. I mean, it's just a lovely sense of continuity and tradition, and it's fun, and it's beautiful to watch. And so the parades of all the red uniformed troops and so on, all the lifeguards and this, that and the other, that'll be a lovely thing to watch.
In the south of England, Vanessa De Morgan.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it because I think it'll be a wonderful day. I think one's got a feeling that it's a new life, all starting again. I have great hopes of the royal family. I really do. I think that it's been perhaps a tricky time. People really feel that he's the right person in the right place. I have great hopes.
In Surbiton, Bob Sewell.
Well, I hope you have a long life as a king and really be prosperous and bring our country as it should be.
Arthur Edwards.
It's the British royal family. It's the number one royal family in the world, isn't it? So everybody's going to be watching it. You know, it will be an amazing occasion. What I'm really looking forward to is I'm going to be photographing him and Camilla on the balcony at Buckingham Palace after the service, where hopefully they'll both be wearing the crowns, because I've photographed him on that balcony so many times. It'll be the first time when I'm photographing him on that balcony as our king. And I'm looking forward so much to that. I'm thinking about nothing else at the moment.
Major General Christopher Geeker.
I think probably the same as all guardsmen, all soldiers, sailors, and aviators who are on parade, in that, first of all, I feel very privileged to be part of the coronation of a British monarch. It doesn't come around often, and so it's a privilege to be part of it. I think the second is a determination to do the very best we can, first of all, for the King and Queen, but also for the broader services and for the British nation. You know, this is what we do. And the third thing, I think, is to lay on a really great display, because lots of people will be watching around the world, and we owe it to the King to do our best.
But the last word goes to Stan Pell at the Royal Star and Garter Home in Solihull.
Well, I like Charlie because I think he's a genuine man. I do. I read faces and I can tell.
But if I may be indulged for one moment, the coronation for my family is a very special occasion, because 70 years ago, it was the day our parents met, and so began 67 years of a long and happy marriage. On behalf of Major General Tim Hyams, the staff and volunteers at ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, we send not only loyal greetings to their Majesties the King and Queen, but every warm wish your coronation to come, heralding a new era, a time of celebration, and much to be thankful for. And wherever this may find you on the 6th of May, we wish each and every one of you an enjoyable, memorable, and great day. Echoing the words of our national anthem, long may our sovereign and his queen reign over us, happy and glorious, and ever give us cause to sing with heart and voice, God save the King. my thanks to Hugh Cantley, George Lorne, Vanessa de Morgan, Peter Snow, Arthur Edwards, Kate Adie, Major General Alistair Bruce, Robert Hardman, Major General Christopher Geeker, and Royal Star and Garter Home residents Bob Sewell and Stan Pell for taking part in the programme, and to the many more who helped make it happen. ABF the Soldiers Charity is proud to be a long-term supporter of both the Erskine Edinburgh and Royal Star and Garter care homes, who look after our ageing veterans. Robert Hardman's Charles III, The Making of a Modern Monarch, Peter Snow's Kings and Queens, The Real Lives of the English Monarchs, and Arthur Edwards' new book, Behind the Crown, My Life Photographing the Royal Family, can be purchased online and in all good bookshops. The National Anthem was performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and sung by the City of London Choir, conducted by Hilary David Wetton. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to listen to previous episodes or learn more about the work of the Soldiers' Charity, please visit our website, soldierscharity.org. And for me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening and farewell.
I hope I get it on the front page of the paper too, which is what you've got to hope for, Harry.